started?
Sure.
All right. Well, we'll start the meeting like we normally do with a moment of silent meditation to be used as you see fit. We'll start it with a serenity prayer. Serenity prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Jim Powers. And my sobriety date is February 18th, 2002. I have not been forced or wanted to take a drink or a mind-altering drug since that time. I'm glad you all are back. We are in week six of this 10-week study that might go to 9 weeks and it might go to 13 weeks. Just depends on how much I talk. To recap a little bit from last week, we started how it works. We read through the 12 proposals, as they're called, or the 12 steps. And what we learned is the steps that are on the wall are really condensed versions of what is in the book on how to do them. And we went through the third step and the third step prayer. I'm a firm believer in that third step being the surrender step. And Chuck Seitz talks about the surrender beyond the surrender in a book called A New Pair of Glasses. That is something that I've had to learn over and over again, that I have to surrender not only my will in my life, my alcoholism, but everything in my life. I have to surrender to the God of my understanding, the God that I found through the chapter We Agnostic, because if my problem was powerlessness, then what I had to find was a power, and I had to find a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity and then take care of all my problems. And that's what's happened in my life. Now, last week when we were going over the fourth step, we were using the guidance that came out of the big book and one of the other papers that I used to hand out something, because I'm just going to hit a highlight on this today. And this is kind of a guide that Joe and Charlie started. Those guys are like world-renowned on the big book studies. And what I'm going to do is, when we looked at the fourth step, we had three columns, is what Bill originally wrote. He wrote the columns, where am I? I'll get back to where it is. On page 65, where he was talked about the write down the resentment in column one, the cause in column two, and what it affects in column three. But as you read through the book and study it, there's really five columns, because it asks us to look at ourselves and where was I to blame? Column four. You know, when it says putting out of my mind the wrongs others have done, I looked at my own mistakes and what did I do? What was the exact nature of my wrong? And column five is where had I been the instigator? Where had I been selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate? What character defects caused me to do what I did? Because in column one, and each one of these, the first one is resentment, then it's fears, then it's sexual conduct, and then it's harms done others, which we'll read about in another page or so. When I wrote down column one, and I wrote down my resentments, and I'm going to use an example from my life, okay? A girl, all right? I was resentful at this girl. Why? Because, you know, the cause was because she left me for no reason. You know, there was no reason. And then, you know, column three, you know, what did it affect? Well, damn, it affected everything. It affected my personal relationship, my self-esteem, my sex. It affected everything. And then when I looked at column four and column five, where I wrote down in column one, I was a victim. I was a victim of what this person did to me. And by the time I got to column four, where I had been to blame, and column five, where had I been selfish, I realized I was the perpetrator. I was the one who started the ball rolling. I was the one. Nobody forced me to date this girl. Nobody forced me to drink alcohol. Okay? But going from a victim in column one to being the one that caused it in column four and five is what I'm trying to get across to you. And it's in the book, when we put out the wrongs that others have done us, where have I been self-seeking, selfish, self-centered? And I had to look at, she didn't do anything wrong. She did the same thing alcohol did. It made me feel good at first, and I knew it was going to hurt me, and I kept going back. And so I couldn't blame her. I had to blame myself, and I had to put her out of my mind. Okay? So what we're going to do, and I do these things really, I read line by line the first 103 pages in the big book. And the reason I read those 103 pages line by line is because that's where the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are contained. After page 103, you get into to the wives, to the family afterwards, and to the employers. And I don't have anything to offer. I don't have a wife, but I don't have anything to offer a significant other person in my life. I don't have anything to offer my employer. And I don't have anything to offer my family if I haven't done the spiritual principles in the first 103 pages. And that's why I spend so much time going over it line by line. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start, and I'm going to use a couple of little books today too, because I like to bring in other AA-approved books. But we were reading on page 74. We're in step 5. And what we're doing now is we've made a list. We've done the fourth step. We've written it all down. We've argued with ourselves about why we should have to tell somebody else all of our defects of character. And in the middle of page 74, it says, if we cannot or would not rather do this, we search, and they're talking about going to a clergyman or some ordained religion, we search our acquaintance for a closed-mouth, understanding friend. Okay? In the paragraph above it, it talks about a person to whom we take this intimate and confidential step. All right? So we look for a closed-mouth, understanding friend. And it talks about perhaps our doctor or psychologist will be the person. It might be one of our own family, but we cannot disclose anything to our wives or our parents which will hurt them or make them unhappy. And I go on to say aunts, uncles, children, anybody in the family. Remembering that when this book was mailed, this was the original 12-step call. So they didn't have sponsors. And so they're trying to tell people in a clear-cut way that they need to do this with somebody. And even if they have to do it with a family member, they have to be careful if they're doing it with a family member that they don't say something or do something that's going to cause them harm, because we're going to be looking at that in a few minutes. It says right there, it says, which would hurt them and make them unhappy. We have no right to save our own skin at another person's expense. Such parts of our story we tell to someone who will understand yet be unaffected. The rule is we must, another one of those musts, be hard on ourselves but always considerate of others. Notwithstanding the great necessity for discussing ourselves with someone, it may be one who is so situated that there is no suitable person available. And if that's so, this step may be postponed. Only. However, if we hold ourselves in complete readiness to go through with it at the first opportunity, we say this because we are very anxious that we talk to the right person. It is important that he is able to keep confidence, that he fully understands and approves what we are driving at. Again, on that page, three times it talks about confidence. And I'm gonna read something out of a book called The Little Red Book. Before Bill wrote The 12 and 12, Dr. Bob used a book called The Little Red Book that explained the steps a little bit further. And then when Bill wrote The 12 and 12, and got approval in 1950 for the 12 traditions to be put into effect. 13 years after the big book, he wrote the 12 steps and 12 traditions. We call it 12 by 12. And then the little red book went out of AA's history. But Dr. Bob on page 72 says, if in doubt about when to take step 5, take it immediately. It is far better to take it before we think we are ready than to postpone it and not take it at all. Many members with years of sobriety in AA find that taking step 5 from time to time helps them maintain their continued sobriety. And it goes on the next page. The metamorphosis from the alcoholic to the new AA personality becomes more evident upon completion of step 5. We are impressed with the simplicity of this effective spiritual device that started our spiritual awakening. The step is a direct challenge to our sincerity because we have been promised humility, a spiritual experience, and a loss of fear when we have talked over our defects with a third person. So that's That was what Dr. Bob was using. Now, Bill was going all over the country starting groups. Dr. Bob stayed in Akron and worked with over 5,000 alcoholics in the hospital there with Sister Ignatia. And so Bill was seeing all these things that were developing around the nation, groups starting and then groups disbanding because of the egos that we alcoholics have. You know, I always say go to a group conscious meeting and then see if you want to go back. That's in my area. Up here, y'all are a little more calm and collected. I haven't seen a screaming person yet in a group conscious meeting here. I don't know that there hasn't been in the past. I'm seeing a smile and a nod, so okay. But the whole thing is, when Bill was seeing all these things, he was formulating the 12 traditions, and he was writing them in the Grapevine. The little magazine that was put out is called Meeting in Print. And by 1950, he had written all 12 of the long form of the traditions, and then he had to convince Dr. Bob at the 1950, the first international convention in Cleveland, to have these accepted. And Dr. Bob at first didn't want to do it. He said, we've got a program, we don't need anything extra. But he became convinced by Bill that really and truly for AA to survive, we needed those 12 traditions. And so that's when the 12 of 12 came into play 2 years after Bob died, is when it was written and published. And I'll use a little bit of it. I normally don't bring the 12 and 12 in until we get into the sixth step, but today I'll bring in a little bit of it, I think. Okay, it goes on the top page of 75. It says, when we've decided who's to hear our story, we waste no time, right? Immediately. We have a written inventory, and we're prepared for a long talk. We explain to our partner what we're about to do and why we have to do it. Why we have to do it. Because we've already found out that if we decide, it says in the beginning of this chapter, that if we don't do this, we might not get over drinking. And it's similar to what a statement at the end of the fourth step in the inventory when it says, if our conduct continues to harm people and we're not sorry for it, we're sure to drink. And they go on to say, we're not theorizing, this is a fact that was presented to them. So again, they're saying that this is something we must do. He should realize that we are engaged upon a life and death errand. Most people approached in this way will be glad to help, and they'll be honored by our confidence. And so we sit down with them, and this next paragraph, I'm going to read it, and then I'm going to read it a second time. The reason I'm going to do that is because this is where the fifth step promises are. There's promises in every step. We read the ninth step promises at a lot of meetings, but a lot of times we don't read the fifth step or the second step promises. But here it is. We pocket our pride and we go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, no secrets, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. All right? Now I'm going to read it again. Once we have taken this step withholding nothing, we are delighted. That's a promise. We can look the world in the eyes. That's a promise. We can be alone at perfect peace. That's a promise. And ease. That's a promise. Our fears will fall from us. That's a promise. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. That's the sixth promise right there. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, seven, but now we are beginning to have a spiritual experience. That spiritual experience is eight and nine promises. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared to be ten will often come strongly. We feel that we are on the broad highway, 11, walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. There's 12 promises in that one paragraph. If you read it slowly and you look at them, there are 12 promises in the fifth step right there.
How is we feel we are on the broad highway of promise?
We're on the broad highway walking hand in hand with our Creator.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, now it tells us, you know, what we're going to do. We're going to sit around for a couple of weeks, and we've done our fifth step now. We've withheld nothing, and so, you know, there's no timelines in this program. Take your time, right? You hear that all the time. Easy does it. Well, it says, returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour. That means that we return home after doing our fifth step, and we sit down for an hour right then, not waiting a week to think about it. Okay? Carefully reviewing what we have done, we thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. Taking this book down from our shelves, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first five proposals, the first five steps, we ask if we have omitted anything, for we are building an arch through which we shall walk a free man at last. I talked last week about how Bill studied in engineering, and he talked about foundations, and he talked about cornerstones, and he talked about arches. And it says, is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? Now, we've just finished the fifth step. We've gone home. We've spent an hour. We reviewed the first five proposals. And then what do? We do not stand around waiting. We go immediately. Page 76. If we can answer to our satisfaction, we then look at step 6. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable, our defects of character, our shortcomings, our wrongs, whatever you want to call them, they're all the same thing. Can He now take all of them, every one? If we still cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us to be willing. So step 6 is a prayer. It's a willingness to let God remove these defects of character. When ready, we say something like this. And it says it two or three times in the book. He's not telling you, Bill's not telling you what specific prayers you have to use. He's giving you guidance on certain prayers that have worked for the first 100. My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. We have then completed step 7. They're wanting you to get through the 12 steps as quickly as possible. In 1939, they are taking people through the 12 steps either in 3 or 4 hours or in 2-day sessions. That's how fast, because people were desperate and they needed help, and this was the only thing that they found that could help them. Now, I know there's a lot of different ways of doing it. I have to say that the way that I was taught to do it comes straight out of this book. And so when I say that, you know, immediately, at once, now, those are all action words. Those are words that are telling me exactly what I have to do and telling me what kind of time frame I need to have. So we've completed step 7. But now that we, again, action. And we're into the chapter, into action. I like to tell people sometimes when they're early on, well, you'll find that in the chapter, into thinking. Go read that. And then they'll come back and say, there is no chapter, into thinking. I'm like, no kidding. This is not a thinking program, it's an action program. But here it is, now we need more action, without which we find that faith without works is dead. Now before, and I've told everybody in here knows that I have nothing against religion, I'm not religious. But if you go to Dr. Bob's house, which a friend of mine did recently and sent me a postcard of it, it's kind of a museum now, it really is a museum now, and they're in a glass case, is a book that they used before the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous was written. Before they wrote this book, they were using another book when they held meetings with the Oxford Group, and when they first broke away from the Oxford Group, the three groups, Akron, New York, and Cleveland, were using a book. And it's in a glass case, it's open to a page, and it's the Bible. That's what they were using when they were first doing the 6 steps of the Oxford Group. They were using the Bible. Now, this book is not written from the Bible. The Bible is one of the books that Bill used. But there were 13 other books that Bill also used when he wrote this. And like I said last week, when he got to the how it works section, he almost quit. He almost quit the entire program. He almost quit writing the book, because each time he would write a chapter, it would be sent out to Akron, and then he would have 99 other people say, well, you ought to change this, you ought to change that, you ought to change this. And so 99 other alcoholics were changing what Bill was writing. And when he got to chapter 5, he said, either you all are going to give me the right, because chapter 5, How It Works, was rewritten 44 times before it was published. And Bill had had it. And he said, either you're going to give me permission after this chapter to write the book, because they said, Bill, you got to take the word must out. Alcoholics can't have must. And you got, we don't follow directions real well, so you can't have directions. And so chapter 5 is written differently than the first four chapters, and it's written from here on out. Bill is writing it in his own way. He's still sending it out to them, but they're not getting to make the changes, because the ultimatum he gave them is, either you all write the book or you let me write it. And they didn't want to write the book, and so they were just following him. So when it says faith without works is dead, I think that's somewhere in the book of James, I'm not sure. But it goes on immediately to say, let's look at steps 8 and 9. Not just 8, but 8 and 9. And we have a list of all persons we had harmed and whom we are willing to make amends. Where is that list? Thank you. When I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1998, I sat in meetings and I would listen to people say, you know, after I did my fourth step, I burned it. You know, I got rid of all that stuff. I did my fifth step with my sponsor, and then we burnt my fourth step. And I said, yeah, that way it's never laying around, right? And my sponsor told me, when I finally got sober and started working the steps, you tell me in the book where it says you burn your fourth step, because you're going to need it again. And I'm like, I am? He goes, yeah. And so we read this together, and this is where he said, that's where your fourth step come back. You took it inventory, and not everybody going on my eighth step list or me making amends to them on my ninth step comes from my fourth step. But it's a good starting point. It's a real good starting point, because I wrote down the people that I harmed, but it also gives me an idea on, okay, what do I do from there? Who else can I add to this? Because by now, from the fourth step to the eighth step, I've learned more about myself. I've gotten much more defogged. I have realized that there are other people that are going to have to be added to that step. Now we go to our fellows. Now we go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. We attempt to sweep away the debris which is accumulated out of our efforts to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. Remember, we were the director. If we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes. Remember, it was agreed that at the beginning that we would go to any length for victory over alcohol. All right? It also was agreed that we'd go to any length to have a spiritual experience. And not knowing I was going to get there, I have another set of documents I'm going to hand out.
All right.
Oh, yeah. You have enough? Mm-hmm. I sure do. Very good. I have a sponsor, you make me about 25, just in case I do this again. Very good. So it says on the top of it, steps 8 and 9, and it says, where are we going to find steps 8 and 9? Well, we're starting to read in the big book. It's pages 76 to 83. In the 12 and 12, it's on page 83. All right? So what we're going to do is we're going to look at the list just like we did the other one. And what I have my guys do is I have them fill out the first two columns. Who did I harm? What did I do? And then I sit down with them and we go through it and we find out, asking God to give us guidance, you know, when do I make amends to this person? Do I do it right now? Do I make partial restitution right now if it's a financial amend? Do I defer it until a time when I'm more spiritually fit and these people might have a better chance of accepting the amend? Because the amend isn't saying I'm sorry. I've been saying I'm sorry all my life. There are some people that you should just leave alone. Just not have any contact with ever again. That is the best amend you can make. There are people in my life that I was told by my sponsor, I put him down, I did this person harm, he was a friend of mine. I went out when he was separated from his wife, and she and I dated. We hooked up for a while. They got back together. I wrote his name down and what I did. Now, they had gotten back together. They had reconciled their marriage. They had a 2-year-old baby girl. And I felt like I needed to go tell him that I had an affair with his wife. Yeah. Isn't that pretty stupid? Yeah.
It's all about me.
I want to feel better. I want to make myself feel better, so I'm going to go harm them, right? But my sponsor said, the best thing you're going to do for that person is you're going to leave them alone. You're not going to go around them. You're not ever going to mention that. You're not ever going to bring it up. And that is how you're going to make amends for what you did. And I went, gee, that makes sense. Of course, everything came out of my sponsor's mouth makes sense after he explained it to me. And then the final one's financial. I don't know how many alcoholics have told me, you know, I don't owe anybody any money. And then I sit there and I smile and I go, well, you got credit card debt? No. You ever steal from anybody? Well, yeah, well, you know, a little. Okay. And they go, you know, but do I have to go give them my money? And I always look at them and say the same thing. No, absolutely not. It's their money. You stole it from them. You go take it back and give it to them and make amends. If you can, and it won't create more harm. Okay? Bottom of page 76, probably there are still some misgivings as we look over the list of business acquaintances and friends we have hurt. We may feel different about going to some of them on a spiritual basis. Okay? Let us be assured, to some people we need not and probably should not emphasize the spiritual feature of on our first approach. You know, I found God, forgive me. You know, what's that doing? That's trying to take everything off of me, trying to take all the responsibility away from me and saying, oh, you know, it wasn't my fault that I stole all that money. Yes, it was. It was your fault you stole the money, but you don't need to go there to some people and say, I'm practicing a spiritual program. All right? We have a primary purpose in Alcoholics Anonymous. Remember what it is? Primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Now, on page 77, it says, we might prejudice them if we go to them on a spiritual basis at first. At the moment, we are trying to put our lives in order, but this is not an end in itself. Now, we go from a primary purpose to a real purpose. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be a maximum service to God and the people about us. That is our real purpose, and that is what we're trying to do now. Is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. It is seldom wise to approach an individual who still smarts from our injustice to him and announce that we've gone religious. You know, in the prize ring, this would be called leading with the chin. You know, that's all you got to do is just say, I got religion, you know, whatever I did to you, God will forgive me for it, I hope you will too. Stick my chin out there and wait for somebody to just smack it off. You know, we don't need to do that. What we need to do is we need to go there and we need to make the amends the proper way. Alright? Why lay ourselves open to be branded fanatics or religious bores? We may kill a future opportunity to carry a beneficial message, but our man is sure to be impressed with a sincere desire to set right the wrong. That's the amend, is to set right the wrong. Not, I'm sorry. It's, this is what I did. I'm trying to live a different way of life. Is there something I can do to make this better? And if I've hurt you in any other way, would you tell me? And then sit down and shut up and let them talk. Don't defend yourself. Don't try to retaliate. Because a lot of times when I start to make an amend, I don't realize how many other things I hurt that person with. how many other things that that person's been carrying with them. And if I only say, well, I'm making amends for A, and I've got B, C, D, E, you know, I need to let them have the opportunity to tell me if I've got any other amends to make. He's going to be more interested in a demonstration of goodwill, I'm going to read this twice, than in our talk of spiritual discoveries. He's going to be more interested in a demonstration. Don't tell me. Show me. A lot of times in families and in relationships, the best amend is what? A living amend. Demonstrate that I'm living a different way of life, that I've changed my way of life. Demonstrate. And I am going to jump real quick just to read one thing, because this is kind of cool. I got it today in my daily thing from my sponsor. It's from As Bill Sees It. The essence of growth. Let us never fear needed change. Certainly we have to discriminate between changes for worse and changes for better, but once a need becomes clearly apparent to an individual, in a group, or in AA as whole, it has long since been found out that we cannot stand still and look the other way. The essence of all growth is a willingness to change for the better, and then an unremitting willingness to shoulder whatever responsibility that entails. Alright. Now, we don't use this as an excuse for shying away from the subject of God. When it will serve any good purpose, we are willing to announce our convictions with tact and common sense. You know, I'm not running around with a chicken with like a chicken with my head cut off saying, oh my God, I got religion, forgive me. You know, with tact and common sense. You know, I'm practicing another way of life. Every time I've made an amend, I've brought in that I'm trying to practice a spiritual way of life when the time was right. And with me, it was when God was telling me the time's right to let them know that you're trying things. And I've told a couple of you in here, one of the people that I had to go make an amends to that I did not want to make an amends to was somebody in a motorcycle gang that I stole a lot of money from. And I thought, I'm going to die. I'm going to go there. I'm going to die. I stole $10,000 from warlocks down in Central Florida from the treasurer. And he knew it. And I knew I was going to die. But my sponsor said, because that was on your fourth step, because you put it on your eighth step, God's telling you, you need to go make amends to this person. And so I knew where he lived. And I went and knocked on his door, and he came to his door, and he's still the treasurer of the warlocks. What the F do you want? And I thought, okay, he's just going to kill me right here. And I said, I need to know, I don't have $10,000, but I need to know how I can pay you back. I'm trying to live a different way of life. I shouldn't have stolen that money from you. And will you take payments? And something amazing happened. The guy looked at me, this big beard and this burly body and tattoos all over, and he said, you're in that AA crap, aren't you? And I went, yeah, I'm in AA, and I am trying to make amends. And he says, the best amends you can make to me is just stay in AA. You don't owe me anything. You know, that was unbelievable. That was an unbelievable occurrence in my life, because I'm projecting I'm going there to die. I'm taking God with me. And all of a sudden, the guy knows about the program. I don't know if he might have been in the program. I have no clue. We didn't talk much more after that, because when he said, you know, just stay in AA, I was like, there's a good way of, you know, not getting beat up or killed. Okay, we don't use this as an excuse to shy away. Tact and common sense is what we use. The question of how to approach the man we hated will arise. It may be he has done us more harm than we have done him, and though we may have acquired a better attitude toward him, we are still not too keen about admitting our faults. This is all about forgiveness, right there. Nevertheless, with a person we dislike, we take the bit in our teeth. It is harder to go to an enemy than to a friend. And that was true for me. but we find it much more beneficial to us. When we go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit, confessing our former ill feeling and expressing our regret, we are in forgiveness. We are forgiving them for what we perceived all the harms that they've done to us, but we have to do that if we're to receive forgiveness. I said before, when we say the Lord's Prayer, one of the strongest words has just got two letters in it, and it's A-S. Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespassed against us. So I'm asking God to forgive me only as much as I'm willing to forgive somebody else. All right, under no condition do we criticize such a person or argue. Under no condition. So there's not a condition, there's not... This, there's a reason here, or there's a reason there. Bill is saying, under no condition do we criticize such a person or argue. Simply, we tell him that we'll never get over drinking. We'll never get over drinking until we have done our utmost to straighten out the past. We are there to sweep off our side of the street. Our cleaning out our side of the street. You know, Dr. Bob wrote on a prescription one time, trust God, clean house, help others. And that's how he broke down the program. Trust God, first three steps. Clean house, 4 through 9. And then helping others, 10, 11, and 12. So, you know, Bob kept it as simple as possible. We're there to sweep off our side of the street, realizing that nothing worthwhile. And we're on 78 now, which is still, you know, in our inventory. Or in our amends, can be accomplished until we do so. We never trying to tell him what he should do. His faults are not discussed. We stick to our own. If our manner is calm, frank, and open, we will be gratified with the result. If our manner is calm, frank, and open, we will be gratified with the results. In 9 cases out of 10, the unexpected happens. Sometimes the man we're calling upon admits his own fault. So feuds of years standing melt away in an hour. Rarely do we fail to make satisfactory progress. Our former enemies sometimes praise what we are doing and wish us well. The warlock dude, you know? Occasionally they'll offer assistance. It should not matter, however, if someone does throw us out of their office, you know? If we go back to making amends and it's not accepted, it doesn't matter. It's not, we're not there to be patted on the back and say, attaboy. There are people that I have offended in my life that if I ran into, they would want, you know, to kick my ass. Those are the people that I'm not supposed to be contacting. Those are the people that, you know, I've got nothing to make amends to them for. We just didn't like each other for one reason or another. And so for me to go there, and if I do go there, or do run into them on the street, or in Walmart, or something like that, and that's the time, whenever, wherever, God decides that I'm to make that amends, and they say, F yourself, I don't ever want to see you again, the answer is, okay, I accept that. But I'm sweeping off my side of the street right there. We've made demonstrations, done our part, it's water over the dam. Let it go. If they don't accept it, okay. It's on them now because we've gotten it off of us. Whoops. Here's the one that I love when my guys say, well, I don't know what you mean. Most alcoholics owe money. So we do not dodge our creditors. Tell them what we're trying to do. We make no bones about our drinking. They usually know about it anyway, whether we think so or not. Nor are we afraid of disclosing our alcoholism on the theory it may cause financial harm. Approached in this way, the most ruthless creditor will sometimes surprise us. All right, I'm going to stop right there. Last July, I was getting ready to go into bankruptcy. I didn't file for bankruptcy, but I'm going into bankruptcy. And so I owed $20,000 to a credit card company. I'm sober almost 12 years. I know I'm not going to be able to make the payments. And so I write them a letter with the last payment that I'm going to be able to make for a while. And I explained to him, I have borrowed the money from you. I owe you the money. I'm going to pay you the money back. I don't know when because my job right now is not making any money, I'm not borrowing any more money. I've torn up my credit card. I still had more money I could have borrowed. But I wrote them a letter in advance of defaulting. And I still defaulted. And we still went through the whole default routine where they called me every day and harassed my brother up here in Georgia because we had the same name and the same policy. And day after day, I would take the call and say, I told you I was going to pay you back. I don't have the money today. And the next day, somebody else would call. Well, do you have $350 today? No, I do not. And that went on for months until it went to a collection agency. And it's at a collection agency right now with a letter from me saying as soon as I sell the property that I own in the state of Georgia, the first check is going to be the $20,000 check or whatever you'll accept as payment. Because the next paragraph says, what? Arranging the best deal we can, we let these people know we're sorry. Now, my drinking wasn't part of my credit card debt. I paid off all my credit card debt when I got a divorce and got sober. So this was over a period of time that I accumulated more credit card debt because real estate bottomed out on me. And that's my profession. And so I had to borrow money to make child support payments to stay alive. And it just rang up. I owe the money. I'm going to pay the money. They know I'm going to pay the money. So do I think they're going to give me 50 cents on the dollar? No. I think they're going to give me a dollar on a dollar, and I'm going to pay them $20,000. And you know what? I got no problem because I borrowed that money. All right? So whether it's you owe the money because you were drinking or you owe the money when you're sober, it's still money that you have borrowed from somebody else. And a guy that I worked with for a while down in Florida said, yeah, but you know those credit card companies are all run by banks, and banks have this whole loss department, you know, and so they can just write it off, and they really don't have to have it back. And he said, his sponsor told him, he said, you know, I've talked with your parents. They're shareholders in Bank of America. So the money that you owe Bank of America, you really owe your parents. So if you're thinking it's just going to be written off, it's not. You have to pay the money back. And he owed $50,000, and it took him 5.5 years, and he paid it all back. And when he wrote the last check, it was the greatest feeling he ever had because he felt like he was repaying his parents. He'd already made amends to them, but this financial one, through a bank, through a credit card company, was still benefiting his parents in some way or form. Okay, so we can arrange the best deal, and if it was our drinking that made us slow to pay, you know, we've got to let them know that. We don't have to write them and say, hey, I'm a drunk, you know. All they got to do is look at your credit card statement. You know, Joe's Lounge, ABC Liquor, gee, you're having a good old time. You know, I know that's confidential information from everybody else except for the people you borrow the money from. So, all right. We lose fear. We must lose, another must. This book is full of musts. This is Bill writing again. He's put them back in. We must lose our fear of creditors no matter how far we have to go, for we are liable to drink if we're afraid to face them. He continues to say that if we don't do these things, and this is not just Bill sitting around saying, I think this will happen. This is his experience of 3.5 years, almost 4 years, of working with alcoholics, and then these first 100 stay sober to write the book, 79 to 100, however many. But they were watching people that were afraid or wouldn't pay back their creditors, and they were watching them go out and drink again. And so he's not theorizing. He's demonstrating to us, and he's writing out exactly what they saw happening. And this is what they were doing. Now, here's a great one. Perhaps we've committed a criminal offense, which might land us in jail if we're known to the authorities. We may be short in our accounts and unable to make good. Now, we've already admitted this in confidence to another person, but we are sure we'd be imprisoned or lose our job if it were known. Maybe it's only a petty offense such as padding the expense account. Most of us have done this thing. And I'm going to stop and use two examples right here. There was a guy that a friend of mine was working with down in Orlando, and he got to this step. Now, he still had a warrant out for his arrest for unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. And so his sponsor said, okay, we're going to go talk to an attorney. We're going to talk to the DA. And it was something that was going to be somewhere between 2 and 5 years in jail. And he said, you know, would you rather drink or would you rather go make amends for this and see what kind of deal? He did 11 months. We visited him every week. We sent him material. He stayed sober. He helped other alcoholics in jail. God put him in jail for that 11 months to carry the message behind the wall. He came out. He's living a great life. Another example, and I read this in a magazine that is absolutely the truth other than the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, called the National Enquirer, and it happened in the state of Alabama. And a lady, apparently, because this is a story, a lady in her fourth step told her sponsor that she had committed murder. And her sponsor contacted the authorities, and she's doing a life sentence in the state of Alabama prison system right now. Now, was that a very good sponsor to hold that in confidence?
By playing God.
Yeah, you think? You think? That one right there blew me away, because I said to myself, that just couldn't happen. And then when I realized it was in Alabama, I said, well, maybe in Alabama. Sorry about that. Could have been anywhere. Could have been anywhere. But what we have to do is we have to make sure that we're doing the right thing. You know, am I going to go to jail needlessly for something I did, and then my wife, my family aren't going to have any food? You know, have I padded the expense account at my office? Well, then I'm going to go to my broker and I'm going to say, hey, you know, on those trips I was out of town, I really didn't stay in the Holiday Inn. I stayed in Motel 2 and hung out with a bunch of people and drank, and, you know, and I owe this money. And I make amends for the money. All right, top of the next page. How many pages do I have? Good, I got plenty. It says, maybe we are divorced and have remarried, but we haven't kept up the alimony to number one. She's indignant about it and has a warrant out for our arrest. And back then, that's a common form of trouble too. Although these reparations take innumerable forms, there are some general principles which we find guiding. Reminding ourselves that we have decided to go to any length to find a spiritual experience, we ask that we be given the strength and direction to do the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences may be. We may lose our position or reputation or face jail, but we are willing. We have to be. We must not shrink at anything. Now, maybe that lady needed to be in jail for what she did, to carry the message behind bars. It wasn't her sponsor's job to go turn her in. It was her job going after the fourth step through the ninth step, getting guidance from God on whether she should go turn herself in. And that's what it's saying to me. We can't shrink at anything. Usually, however, other people are involved. Therefore, we are not to be hasty and foolish martyr who would needlessly sacrifice others to save himself from the alcoholic pit. Now, what's that mean? Well, basically it means that, you know, if other people are involved, I'm not going to bring them down with me. If I have to go make amends, you know, and I had to make a lot of amends. Most of y'all know, you know, my early criminal days, I had to make a lot of amends. And there was quite a few other people who went with me. But never once when I went to make an amend to anybody that I could remember that I did something to, did I ever bring along Bob, Bill, Jack, whoever else was there. It's me I'm trying to help, you know. And besides, most of those guys died from alcoholism way before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. We leave other people out. We don't sacrifice others to save myself from the alcoholic pit. A man we know had, he's talking about another guy they knew. A man we know had remarried. Because of resentment and drinking, he had not paid alimony to his first wife. She was furious. She went to court and got an order for his arrest. He had convinced our way of life, a spiritual way of life, had secured a position and was getting his head above water. It would have been impressive heroics if he had walked up to the judge and said, "Here I am. You know, there's an arrest for me." And we thought he ought to be willing to do that if necessary, but if he were in jail, could he provide nothing for either family, the one he's remarried or the one that he owes money to? We suggested he first write his first wife, admitting his faults and asking for forgiveness. He did, and also sent a small amount of money. He told her what he would try to do in the future. He said he was perfectly willing to go to jail if she insisted. Well, in that case, you know, of course she did not. She didn't want him in jail, but she wanted the money. And the whole situation has long been since adjusted. Let's see where I'm going to stop here. Okay. Page 80. Before taking drastic action which might implicate other people, we secure their consent. If we have obtained permission, have consulted with others, ask God for help, to help, and the drastic step is indicated, we must not shrink from it. And this brings to mind a story about one of our friends. While drinking, he accepted a sum of money from a bitterly hated business rival. Given him no receipts for it, he subsequently denied having received the money and used the incident as a basis for discrediting the man. He thus used his own wrongdoing as a means of destroying the reputation of another. In fact, his rival was ruined. He felt that he had done a wrong he could not possibly make right. If he opened that old affair, he was afraid it would destroy the reputation of his partner, disgrace his family, and take away his means of livelihood. What right had he to involve those dependent upon him? How could he possibly make a public statement exonerating his rival? Well, after consulting with his wife and partner, he came to the conclusion that it was better to take those risks than stand before his creator guilty of such ruinous slander. He saw that he had to place the outcome in God's hands, and that's where we place all the outcome. From step 3 on, all the outcomes are placed in God's hands. Or he'd soon start drinking again, and all would be lost anyhow. He attended church for the first time in many years, and after the sermon, he quietly got up and made an explanation. His actions met widespread approval, and today he's one of the most trusted citizens in this town. And that all happened years ago. Tell you what. Let me keep going. The chances are that we have domestic troubles. Perhaps we were mixed up with women in a fashion we wouldn't care to have advertised. Yep. We doubt if, in this respect, alcoholics are fundamentally much worse than other people. But drinking does complicate sex relations in the home. You think? After a few years with an alcoholic, a wife, and I've got written in here a husband, gets worn out, resentful, and uncommunicative. How could they be anything else? The husband begins to feel lonely, sorry for himself. He commences to look around in the nightclubs or their equivalent for something besides liquor. Perhaps he is having a secret and exciting affair with a girl who understands. Sure. In fairness, we must say that she may understand, but what are we going to do about a thing like that? A man so involved often feels very remorseful at times, especially if he is married to a loyal and courageous girl who has literally gone through hell for him. And what Bill's describing right there is Lois. He's describing his own wife, you know, because Bill was, and it's in many books, kind of a womanizer, all right? Whatever the situation, we usually have to do something about it. If we are sure our wife does not know, should we tell her? Well, it says, not always, we think. If she knows in a general way that we have been wild, should we tell her in detail? No. Undoubtedly, we should admit our fault. She may insist on knowing all the particulars. That is not necessary. They're going to tell us that. She may want to know who the woman is and where she is. And we feel we ought to say to her that we have no right to involve another person. We are sorry for what we have done, and God willing, it shall not be repeated. More than that, we cannot do. We have no right to go further. Though there may be justifiable exceptions, and though we wish to lay down no rule of any sort on this, we have often found this the best course to take. Which was my case in point. You know, I wanted to make amends to a friend. But in doing so, what would happen? It would have harmed them, you know. When I made my amends to my ex-wife, I did it in a general way on this. I was unfaithful to you in the last couple of years of our marriage when we were having all our real problems with my alcohol. It's out of control. I'm not blaming it on alcohol. I had a problem. I was looking for that understanding woman in other places. And I just have to admit to you that I made a mistake and I'm not going to do it again with God's help. I am still not forgiven 13 years later. And you know what? It's okay. It's okay. You know. Our design for living is not a one-way street. It is good for the wife as it is for the husband. Page 82. If we forget, so can she. It is better, however, that one does not needlessly name a person upon whom she can vent jealousy. Perhaps there are some cases where the utmost frankness is demanded. No outsider can appreciate such an intimate situation. It may be that both will have to decide that the way of good sense and loving kindness is to let bygones be bygones. Each might pray about it, having the other one's happiness utmost in mind. Keep it always in sight that we're dealing with that most terrible human emotion, jealousy. Good generalship may decide the problem be attacked on the flank rather than risk face-to-face combat. You know, instead of going at it face-to-face, it might be nice to come around to the side and just say, you know, I'm admitting my faults, I'm admitting I did this, and I'd like to make amends and stay with you. And a lot of families stay together. Some don't. That's up to God. That's not up to me. All right, one more paragraph. If we have no such complication, there's plenty we should do at home. Sometimes we hear an alcoholic say that the only thing he needs to do is to keep sober. I've got one of my guys in Orlando right now. He's sober a year. He goes to a few meetings. He still gets in fights with his soon-to-be ex-wife. He still argues. And then he calls me and says, but I'm not drinking. You know, isn't that great? I'm not drinking. Now, this guy has tried for 20 years. And he never got a year. That was one of the guys that I drove down to Orlando to see get his first year. Because for 20 years, in and out of AA, he couldn't do this deal. And yet he still calls me and says, well, I'm not drinking. I said, are you helping somebody else? Are you going to meetings? Because even just being in meetings is doing 12-step work. Well, my job, I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear it. What I want to hear from you is that you're holding the door tomorrow night at the 6 o'clock meeting, and then you go back to your job. Because just not drinking ain't going to get it. Dry drunks, untreated alcoholism kills an awful lot of us.
Yes.
All right? Certainly he must keep sober, for there'll be no home if he doesn't. But he is yet a long way from making good to the wife or parents for whom years he is shockingly treated. Passing all understanding is the patience of mothers and wives have had with alcoholics. Had this not been so, many of us would have no homes today, would perhaps be dead. All right, we're going to pick up at the tornado in 10 minutes, so I'll give everybody a 10-minute break to take a smoke.